This episode describes the events of the UT Tower shooting on August 1st, 1966. This episode was recorded before the shooting at Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, where at least 17 people lost their lives on February 14th, 2018. Our deepest condolences go out to everyone affected by this horrible tragedy. Due to the nature of the recent news from Florida, listener discretion is advised. All Crime, No Cattle, Episode 10. This week, we're brought to you by the common cold, because I feel awful.
Yeah.
I think, you know, a few weeks ago, I actually mentioned that I thought I was coming down with something, and then I was fine, but it finally has come upon me.
Yeah.
It's dropped me like a bag of stones.
Yeah, and I feel like you've just started to get me sick. I'm not completely sick
yet. Oh, absolutely.
Yet.
We've got at least 2 weeks of being sick, because now you're going to get sick, and then you're going to be sick for next week's episode as well. So,
well, thanks a lot,
February. That
should
be an exciting couple of weeks of really great audio podcasting.
Yeah. February. It brings you really good content from All Crime, No Cattle, and sickness.
Mm-hmm. It's the month of love and snot.
Hey, you know what else it is? It's Mardi Gras. And we did go to a banging Mardi Gras party with a crawfish boil. That was cool.
Yep.
So for all those true crime fans out there who happen to be Canadian and or French Canadian or French, laissez le bon temps rouler. Vive la Mardi Gras.
All right, Shay. So what kind of horrible story are we listening to today that will make my cold feel minuscule in comparison?
So today we're going to be talking about, it's probably one of the better covered cases that we've done so far in our podcast. This is the University of Texas mass killer who sniped his victims from the university tower. And so this takes us back to 1966 in Austin, Texas. I'm using a couple of things for reference material on this case, and I'd like to take a quick side note and say that there is a lot of material out there for this particular case, and there's a lot of misinformation and mixed up details due to the way this case was spread around in the media. I actually started researching this case and got caught up in a lot of that misinformation until I found two really good sources, and one of those is A Sniper in the Tower, The Charles Whitman Murders by Gary Laverne. And Gary Laverne is a very good Texas author of true crime. I'm actually using another one of his books in a case that's coming up that's going to be one of our Lone Star Lunatic cases. He's a very highly decorated author of Texas true crime. The other source that I'm going to be using is the Charles Whitman documentary from True TV called The Texas Tower Sniper. Okay, so this is a story of one of the most horrific mass killings in Texas history. It's also a story of a seemingly normal young man whose mind became broken, after which the slaughter and bloodshed that occurred on August 1st in 1966 would change America forever. Now, Aaron, do you know anything about this case going forward, except for basically, I guess, the basics?
No, I mean, I know a little bit about it. I know that my mom actually, I think, brought this up to us, and I think is the instigator for this episode, right?
Yeah.
Because she told us some of the details, because this is something that she lived through, although she was very young when it happened. And so she knew about it, and she told us a lot of the details, and it was a lot of information that I didn't know. And I don't think a lot of people know the full details, since this is a case that happened, what, 50 years, well, over 50 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
And is something that is now has been eclipsed many times over by other mass shootings in United States history. So I don't think it's something that we really talk about that much anymore, which is, I think, a little unusual for something, an event that happened that was so big.
Yeah. And also, there's a few other things that are happening in these mid to early 60s that help to kind of cover up this particular event. And we're going to get into some of those here in a second. So let's go ahead and get into Charles Whitman, who is the shooter in this case. We're going to discuss some of his early life. Charles Whitman was born June 24th, 1941, in the small town of Lake Worth, Florida. Charles's mother, Margaret, was a homemaker, and she loved her children very much. Charles's father, however, Charles Whitman Sr., was a strict and overbearing self-made man. He had built a successful contracting business from scratch and was also very abusive to his family. And you're going to see here that we're getting into sort of a dragon dad situation like we did when we were covering the case of Bill Butterfield. Charles Sr. is the sort of man that was a perfectionist and also beat his children and wife frequently. Charles Sr. was also the sort of man who was open to talk about this. He would openly talk about beating his children and his wife, but would be quick to say that it was for their own good and that he loved them.
Well, yeah, this is what, 40s, 50s, especially in the South. I mean, a lot of people thought that way back then.
So we said it in the episode before, spare the rod, spoil the child. It has that corporal punishment, disciplinarian kind of mindset, and people are quick to overlook it. But my question is about the wife. He would openly talk to his buddies about, yeah, I roughed up my wife a little bit, but I love her. And it's because she was mouthing off or getting out of line, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it comes from the same mentality that the man is the master of his domain. And he's, I mean, especially back then, there still was the mindset that the husband kind of owned or was in control of the wife as just as much as he was the children.
Yeah. And so keep that in mind when you start thinking about Charles Whitman Jr.'s psyche as he's growing up and becoming an adult and trying to figure out what it is to be a man in 1966.
Yeah.
So Charles Jr. began quickly building a hatred for his father at a very early age. One of the few things that he had in common with his father, though, was hunting. And so he would go out on these hunting trips with his dad. And that was like the one time that they could actually do something that they both actually cared about and that they enjoyed. Other than that, he hated his dad. So along with the hunting, another one of the few ways that Charles could kind of please his dad was his shooting skills, which kind of goes into the hunting, but also marksmanship and target shooting. Because Charles Jr. was a very good shot. And Charles Sr. had this big love obsession for weapons. And he definitely imprinted that on all three of his sons. And if I haven't mentioned it yet, Charles did have two other brothers, but they're not really involved in the case, so I'm just going to skip over that for now. Charles Sr. also kept a collection of over 65 firearms in their home, which seems like quite the collection.
A little excessive.
Yeah. And there are pictures of the three Whitman boys huddled around rifles during Christmas time in the family photo albums. And by 12 years old, Charles Jr. was an expert shot. And his father once said that of Charles that he could shoot the eye out of a squirrel at 50 yards, which seems kind of ridiculous to me, but maybe he could at that young of an age. When he was 12 years old, Charles actually became the youngest Eagle Scout in America. But underneath all this all-American image, young Charles was beginning to hate authority and rebel against his father's wishes. On Charles's 18th birthday, he went out with his friends for a night of partying, and when he returned, he was kind of outside by the family pool, kind of sobering up, drinking his last beer, and his father came out infuriated. He was upset that Charles was drunk and had been out partying late. He continued to beat him and throw him in the family pool and shove him underwater. And Charles was so beaten up at the time and drunk that his father almost drowned him that night.
Yikes.
With his mother's encouragement and to escape his father, Charles joined the U.S. Marine Corps, being that he's 18 years old now and he can make those kind of decisions. This was likely a decision to do something that even his father couldn't change or have an effect on. As far as Charles's initial time in the military, he started out and made an excellent soldier. When he was in boot camp, he tested really highly on all the tests. He had a very high IQ of 138. He was a well...
138? That is high.
Yeah, he was very smart.
Wow.
Yeah, and so we're going to kind of see that in some of the media. Like, if you look around on this case, some of the media tried to portray Charles as someone who is mentally deficient. And this is similar to some other mass shooters in the early 1940s and 50s, just before Charles Whitman's incident.
So this was the media kind of just spinning with these tales, or were these psychiatrists or actual medical people who were saying that they were mentally deficient?
Well, we're going to see something at the end of the case that is also part of a medical angle that they try and take on this case. But mostly it's the media who's trying to say that this is just a lunatic, a crazy person who's lost it.
Yeah, well, I also imagine the science and the psychiatry and psychology wasn't exactly where it is today. So I bet there weren't a lot of people that had been studied who had done something like this. And so I think probably the simplest answer was, oh, well, he was an idiot.
Oh, yeah. And this is kind of the holy grail of forensic anthropology and forensic psychologists who would love to have been able to interview Charles Whitman.
Yeah, because I mean, that's something that's fascinating and frightening, is somebody who is extremely intelligent and also filled with rage, which yes. It seems from what you're saying, it seems like he already is, even at a young age.
Oh, yeah. Well, like we said, he was a well-honed soldier who was almost immediately recognized for his officer capabilities, as well as being a sharpshooter and a marksman. His test scores on the range in particular indicated that he was extremely good in the highest percentile at shooting moving targets that were at long distances downrange.
Ooh, yikes. And that's a bit of foreshadowing, I would imagine.
Yeah. So the Marine Corps actually really liked Charles Whitman a lot. And they liked him so much that they actually awarded him a unique scholarship via the military to study mechanical engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. Unfortunately, Charles, he had no structure and discipline once he reaches this point and moves on to the college campus. So he's leaving the military from the Marines, which is very regimented, has lots of structure, which is what he kind of needed at this point. And now he's on a college campus where no one is there to tell him that he has to go to class, that he has to study, that he has to do this. You know, he's alone in a dorm room.
Yeah, and it also sounds like this is the first time in his life that he ever had that kind of freedom.
Exactly.
Growing up under his father.
It's here where he kind of earns a name for himself for partying, drinking, and also gambling. He quickly runs up a lot of debts with shadier individuals in the Austin area by hosting these all-night party sessions with gambling in his dorm room. And he even begins sleeping with a gun.
For what reason? I mean, out of paranoia or what?
Yeah, because he has some shadier fellows that he knows he owes money to. And he's worried that they're going to come looking for that money.
Yikes.
Yeah. And it's also during his first year of college that Charles begins joking about these sinister daydreams during these drunken party sessions. One such day, while talking to some friends and looking up at the university tower on campus, Charles states, quote, "A man with a decent deer rifle could kill people and hold off a freaking army for as long as he wanted up there."
So that's just something he casually throws out while he's partying.
Oh, yeah. And we're going to see that this, even from early on in his first year of college, this is starting to come up and it's going to be a recurring theme. So on February of 1962, Charles actually meets the love of his life, Kathleen F. Lesner. She was going to school to become a teacher. She was outgoing, fun, she was by all accounts a wonderful person, and the epitome of an all-American girl from a small town in Texas. After 6 months of dating, the two are married.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was a pretty fast engagement and marriage.
How old were both of them at this time?
They're both in their early 20s. Charles is 21. I'm not completely sure. Kathleen, I believe she's also her early 20s. Kathy was also a great student. She was an A student. She worked really hard. She really had a lot of good study habits and a good work ethic. This is something Charles had always struggled with, and he was anything but this kind of a student. So it's kind of an odd couple when it comes to schooling, but I guess his outgoing nature and charisma and the fact that he was in the Marine Corps attracted her to him. It's also kind of, you know, Gary Laverne talks about this in his book. They were kind of the ideal couple in their friend group. You have a Marine who was an Eagle Scout, who is, you know, on his way to becoming an officer and an engineering student. And Kathleen is this young, intelligent, hardworking student who is aspiring to be a teacher.
Yeah, so it sounds like an all-American couple.
Exactly.
Like nothing can ever bad happen to these two.
Unfortunately, the time that they got to spend together in their initial marriage phase is cut short. And it's cut short by the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, so on October 15th, 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis starts. Charles Whitman, whose grades are beginning to slip a little bit, is called into active duty. When he's finally able to return home, Charles is noticeably different. He begins to struggle more with his classes, and the Marines eventually withdraw his scholarship.
Well, I mean, there wasn't really any kind of battle or anything during the Cuban Missile Crisis, so is there an explanation as to why this changed him so dramatically? I mean, when we think about somebody going into the military and changing once they get out, we think of PTSD from being in some kind of combatant situation, but that's not what happened. I mean,
no, I would point us more in the direction of a sort of Bo Bergdahl, if you're familiar with that story. Mm-hmm. Of
season
how...
two of Serial. Check it out.
Yeah.
If you haven't.
Yeah, it's really good. But both of them kind of have similar situations in that they're expecting to have this hero situation, this glorified military tour that never really happens.
Yeah. They're expecting something to stroke their ego and make them kind of feel better about themselves. And when that doesn't come, it almost like squashes their ego. It almost,
exactly.
Or their sense of self.
And that's a big problem when you start talking about people who might be narcissists. And
yeah,
that's interesting to think about when we talk about Charles Whitman. So when he returns back to campus at UT, his grades really start to struggle. He loses his scholarship. And they also, the military, after taking his scholarship away, they are fed up with him. They want him to either go to school and become an engineer or be a soldier. And that window of opportunity is passed after he does not do well in a series of classes. And he's put right back into active military yet again.
Oh, wow. So, I mean, okay, so his scholarship is pulled, but so does he have to drop out of college after that?
Yes. So once his scholarship is pulled, he's lost his military program to go and study to eventually become an officer and get his degree. And the military wants him back in active duty, and that's exactly where he goes. He's sent to Camp Lejeune in North Carolina, and this is actually where Charles starts to not be a good Marine anymore. He gets involved with drinking, more gambling, and possession of illegal firearms. And I think it's also important to remember that right at this point of Charles's timeline, on November 22nd in 1963, President JFK is assassinated in Dallas, Texas via a shooter from a building.
Uh-huh.
Lee Harvey Oswald. Well, days later, after being court-martialed for his gambling, drinking, and possession of an illegal firearm, he gets 30 days in the brig and 90 days hard labor. So this is just a couple days later this happens, and JFK's assassination is on his mind. He's in solitary confinement. He starts writing in a journal, and inside are some of his dark fascinations and ideas about life and death. He actually writes these long passages about hoping that when death comes, he will be able to observe it and understand it and gain some type of enlightenment. And he also continues talking about his fascination with shooting a large number of people. And at this point, we see in his journal that Charles is blaming other people for his problems, namely the Marines themselves, some of his fellow Marines, his father, and the way he was raised, the government. Nothing is Charles's fault. And again, that goes back to his narcissism and keeping his ego inflated, you know. And so after his court-martial and his solitary confinement, Charles starts to get desperate. And he starts to realize that the Marines are not for him and that he wants out.
Wait, how long was he in solitary confinement?
30 days.
Whoa.
Yeah, and he did 90...
That's not going to do good for anybody's mental health, especially somebody who's already dangling on the edge.
Yeah, and he also had limited contact for 90 days when he was doing his hard labor.
Ugh,
so
yikes.
He spent a while in this situation to think about what his next move was. And that particular next move is to contact someone that he never would want to reach out to, and someone you would not expect, his father. Because remember, Charles Sr. has a contracting business with the government, and he has political ties, And he's able to finagle a way for Charles to get discharged from the Marines a year after his court-martial in 1964.
So had he been estranged from his father before this?
For a long part of Charles's military career, his dad didn't even know he was enlisted. And as soon as his dad found out that he was enlisted, he immediately started to get him pulled out of the military by using some of these political ties. But Charles would never agree to it, Charles Jr. And
wait, why was his father trying to get him kicked out of the army?
Because he wanted control of him. He didn't like that he went into the military.
Well, how are you going to get somebody kicked out of the Marines?
Well, that's what he tried to do. I don't know how you would actually do it.
Okay. So his father is able to pull strings in the background to get him honorably discharged, or?
Yeah, well, honorably discharged.
Okay, yeah, because it's only two. It's only dishonorable mm-hmm. and honorable, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so now he is honorably discharged.
Yes.
And I guess coming back home to his wife.
Exactly. So at this point, Charles Sr. and his mother, Margaret, are still in Florida. And he goes home to his new home in Austin to make a home with his wife. His wife, at this point, has completed her degree. And she's working as a teacher, and she also has a second job on the side.
And has been waiting for him all this time.
Oh, yeah.
Through all of the gambling and the court-martialing and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And Charles reapplies to the University of Texas at Austin. And he starts taking courses in architectural engineering. You know, he actually switches around majors quite a few times. And this is one of the things we see that he really doesn't have a focus on his future. He doesn't really have a plan. It's just leaping from one knee-jerk decision to the next.
Well, yeah, hey, you know what? A lot of people did that in our lives.
Hey, I did it. I did it a lot.
You had, what, six majors?
Six majors, yeah.
I only had two, so that's not that bad.
Well, one of them wasn't my fault. One of them was an accident. They accidentally put me in the wrong major to start my first year of college.
What was that?
Architectural engineering, actually.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. I had never wanted to be an architecture major, and I actually was trying to get aerospace, and they just clicked the wrong box.
Oh. Yeah.
So, lacking a clear goal or a direction with his life, Charles begins to resent Kathy. Like we said, she had already graduated and had started her teaching career. She's holding down another job. She's supporting Charles through him trying to rebuild his life and find a new direction. Like we said, he switched several majors. He's struggling in his classes. He can't hold down a side job. He has all these weird side jobs, working as a store clerk, at a loading dock, several other things. He can't hold anything down. He's taking out loans from his dad, who he hates, to support him and his wife. And reports of domestic violence from his neighbors are also occurring. And it's pretty obvious that him and Kathy are getting into it, and he's hitting Kathy. So on March 1966, Charles's mother divorces Charles Sr. in Florida after he severely beats her and they get into a really big argument. And she basically has had enough, and she calls Charles Jr. and says, you got to come get me. I'm leaving your dad. And Charles does. He drives to Florida and he picks up his mother, Margaret. She moves to Austin and begins a new life there.
So does she move in with Charles and Kathy?
No, she actually gets her own apartment. Yeah, she actually started a new job working at a cafeteria and is making her own money. And his dad, Charles Sr., is calling him, trying to get him to talk to his mom and get her to take him back. You know, that kind of situation. And Charles Jr. doesn't want any part of that. But he also doesn't really want his mom living nearby, breathing down his neck either. We'll see a little bit more of that with some of the stresses that in his mind that he's experiencing, whether they're real or not. So again, let's talk about how Charles feels like he is not the man of this household. He is losing his grasp on his wife, his family, his home. He's not doing well in school, even though he's trying to focus on it. He starts having really bad mood swings. He becomes explosive and violent. And on top of that, he's working multiple jobs because he can't hold one down. So he keeps working multiple part-time jobs and switching jobs. And he resorts to taking dextroamphetamines, which is a type of amphetamine. This is basically to help him try and focus and stay awake because he's working a lot of hours. He's going and checking on his mom, helping her out. He's driving Kathy to both of her jobs and then going to school, trying to do his classes. And these amphetamines are helping him stay up at all hours of the night to do his studying and try and focus. But it's kind of a snowball situation. So the more the amphetamines that he starts to take to stay awake, it's kind of like speed. He becomes addicted and it causes him to be jittery, angry. He loses his temper even more often.
Don't do drugs, kids.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, this is the time period where amphetamines were rampant in America. Elvis took them. Jim Jones in Jonestown was known for taking a ton of amphetamines. And it really just fries your neurons. It's like taking speed and you have to have them. And if you don't have them, you sound like you're someone who has Alzheimer's.
Why is that?
Oh, your speech patterning just gets really slowed down. I don't know if you've listened to like the tapes of Jonestown with Jim.
Of course I have, Shay.
Okay, with Jim Jones. How like he's not even that old, but he sounds like a really old man because he's got this slow speech pattern.
Why would speed make your speech pattern slow?
When you don't have it. When you don't have it, you come down really hard and you get really angry and it's like this double-edged sword, the snowball effect that I'm talking about. Like you have to have it to feel normal and you have to have it to focus. And when you don't have it, it's really detrimental to your functioning. So again, this mixed with his already frequent mood swings makes him more explosive, more violent. And it's also hypothesized by some of the forensic psychologists that have studied this case that Charles's substance abuse was dulling his inhibitions and increasing his urge to act out on his rage, this pent-up anger towards his family, the military, and society at large. This sort of follows a typical set of warning signs of mass murderers, as well as their pre-murder ramp-up period. So there's other mass murderers who have followed this kind of same trajectory, to where like they've mentioned, they've talked about their fascinations with solving big, large problems in society with these mass killing events to show a message or show some sort of meaning or to solve some sort of issue with their ego internally. Drugs and drug abuse definitely comes into play with some of these mass murderers.
Like who?
So yeah, we're talking about people like Timothy McVeigh. Who's somebody else?
The Supreme Gentleman, Elliot Rodger.
Where was he from?
California.
Oh, okay.
That's where that rampage happened. A lot of these people who end up doing these acts have a long period of red flag, red flag, red flag, where they're doing a lot of the same things and they're acting out in a lot of the same ways. And unfortunately, no one can kind of get to them early enough before they actually enact these fantasies they have of violence towards the outside world.
Yeah, and psychologically what's going on with this pre-murder ramp up is they'll joke about something, maybe small, maybe say like, oh man, that place up there, that'd be a great place to shoot a bunch of people, ha ha ha, and they're like, oh, you're so crazy, Charles. And that makes it okay in their mind to take the next step of like, well, if someone was going to do that, maybe if I was going to do it, how would I do it? And it makes it kind of okay in their mind. And so it kind of leads to this ramp up where it starts to become uncomfortable and there are lots of red flags that pop up, but nobody ever steps up and does anything about it or says anything. And in the mind of a narcissist and a psychopath, that gives them the green flag to move forward.
Yeah. I mean, this is especially true for the time where I think if somebody was doing and saying these things nowadays, I think there would be more people who would sit up and stay and pay attention and say something. But back then, that probably wouldn't have triggered any kind of weird realization from anybody because people just didn't think that people out there thought like this.
Specifically in this time, because this had never really happened before.
Yeah.
And this is, we're going to see, this is the first real case that makes America think, hey, maybe we should change how we go about these kind of situations. We're talking about red flags because here's another one. So one day in class, the University of Texas at Austin, just the same year that this incident happens, a young woman in Professor Barton Riley's class told him that Charles was telling students he wanted to take a rifle and go up to the tower on campus and shoot a bunch of people.
So this is at least the second time that he's mentioned this.
Yes.
Okay.
Second big giant red flag. The professor comes over to Charles's desk and says, "Now, that's what an old Marine needs to do to prove that he can shoot, right?" And I don't, this is his quote, and this is what he says he said to Charles. I don't even really understand, like, what he's trying to do there. Is he trying to...
This is what an old Marine does to prove that he can shoot?
Yeah.
What? What does that is, even,
is
he kind of
joking? That's what I thought. I was
is
like,
there no additional context?
No,
for that?
He never really explained himself in the interview.
Huh.
This is just from Professor Riley's mouth, what he said to Charles Whitman. And then he moves on to say, Charles never looked up. He just had this really strange, eerie smile on his face. And he continued with his architectural drawings.
Creepy.
Yeah. Well, Whitman, on the advice of his wife, Kathy, who had been pleading for him to go and talk to somebody and get some kind of help, because Kathy is a freaking saint and is still supporting Charles through all this, he goes and talks to a doctor on campus regarding his anxieties and his severe headaches. He again discussed his fantasies about the clock tower and shooting people. The doctor basically tells him these are not normal feelings and we need to do some further appointments and further investigation with this and see if perhaps we need to medicate or, you know, do something else. And Charles never actually shows up for the next appointment. And he lies to Kathy and says that he did go and that everything's fine. But instead, on the exact same day and almost the exact time of his appointment, he's in the logbook as visiting the University Tower.
No.
Yes. He signed the visitor book on the 27th floor.
To visit the tower when he was actually supposed to be in a counseling session.
Discussing these feelings.
Wow, yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah.
So question, was this a psychiatrist or a psychologist? Was this just a school counselor?
It never really goes into detail, and I haven't really found anywhere to see exactly who the doctor was or what their official position was.
Yeah, because my question is,
I don't know if it's a campus physician or if it's a campus counselor.
No matter who it is, if somebody is threatening something like that and you have reason to take them seriously, that's something that I believe you can still notify the authorities about, that because it's not a breach of doctor-patient privileges because you have reason to believe that this person can hurt himself or others.
Yeah.
So yet again, we have another person who maybe doesn't take this as seriously as they should. So he's told at this point many, many people
he
has these fantasies.
Joked about it with several friends, classmates, you know, he's talked about it in the military, which I didn't mention that, but this is a really deep case. There's a lot of interesting stuff. You can go read Gary Laverne's book about it. There's a lot of really cool stuff in there. But yeah, multiple people he said this to.
This is Aaron's little bit of advice for this episode. Every episode I seem to have a little bit of advice for people out there. If somebody you know is talking multiple times about having violent fantasies where they're killing lots of people, go ahead and say something.
Yeah.
Protect them from themselves and also protect the community at large, because there's no reason why you shouldn't take that seriously.
Yeah. At this point also, I don't know if I mentioned this, but Charles Whitman was a Boy Scout leader.
Yeah, you mentioned that. He was the youngest Eagle Scout.
He's a Boy Scout leader at this point.
He's currently a Boy Scout leader.
So he has his own Boy Scout troop that's running.
That's not creepy.
And we actually have some interviews and discussion from people that were in his Boy Scout troop. And this was based out of his neighborhood Catholic church. And he was known for showing the boys of his troop riflery and taking them to the shooting range because that's what he was good at. But members of his troop remember that no one in Austin could shoot like Charles. They were all impressed by his marksmanship and the way he could handle a gun. They looked up to Charles. So boys in his troop said of Charles, though they respected his abilities and the fact that he had achieved Eagle Scout at such a young age, that they were terrified of him. They knew Charles Whitman as a showman, a narcissist, and a scout leader who was quite cruel to them. One scout recalls when Charles was feeling it, he would toss a dollar on the floor and would tell the boys that if they could do what he did, they could have the dollar. And he said, you know, a dollar back then during those times was a lot of money in 1966. And so the kids would get all excited. And then Charles would do a handstand against the wall and start doing push-ups. And afterwards, he would make the boys, he would force every one of them to try and do it. And when they would fall and slam their faces into the floor, he would laugh and then finally snatch up the dollar and say, "See, you're never going to be as good as me."
Okay, Charles.
Yeah. And so, like, I think this is important to bring up because at this point in his life, like, you can see he has his mother living nearby. He's having to support her. He's having to go through this divorce with his dad, with his mom. He's having all these issues psychologically and with his schooling. This is the only area he has control of. This is the only area where he's able to boost.
Powerful.
Yeah, he can feel powerful. He can control young boys. He can boost his ego. And that's where he's getting just a little bit of his gratification from. And in his journals, these are the nicest moments that he talks about in his journals, is helping these young boys.
Oh, wow. Are the cruelest moments of these boys' lives.
Yeah.
Wow.
So let's jump forward to July 31st, 1966. This is the hottest day of the year in Austin. At a typewriter in his home, 26-year-old Charles Whitman began writing a letter attempting to explain his feelings. In the letter it says, "I don't quite understand what it is to compel me to type this letter. Perhaps it is to leave some kind of vague reason for the actions I have recently performed and will be performing. I do not really understand myself these days. I am supposed to be an average, reasonable, and intelligent young man. However, lately, I cannot recall when it started. I have been a victim of many unusual and irrational thoughts." Again, you can see here, like, while he's writing this, he's trying very hard to portray himself as a victim and make excuses about what he's about to do.
Uh-huh.
And we know later that this is the beginning of what is going to become a suicide note. He actually has some friends come over, because this is right in the middle of some exams that he's taking. And normally, Charles would be very anxious and kind of just running around trying to study for his exams. And his friends notice how calm he is and how at peace he is. They're like, "Well, aren't you worried about studying? And, you know, what's going to go on with your exams?" And he just kind of brushes it off and he's fine.
So he's writing a note that is his suicide note that I'm sure also details his plans on what he's going to do. And he has friends come over during all of this and he's just fine. Nobody notices anything weird that's up with him.
In fact, they said the weirdest thing about it was how calm and just plain he was, and that he wasn't worried about school and how weird that was for him. Because, I mean, I guess like me, when a test is coming up, like, I am a wreck. You know, like, I'm studying really hard. I'm strung out. I'm nervous. I have test anxiety. But he's just calm as day. Just fine. And
that's
he's also
really terrifying.
About to murder a bunch of people.
That's terrifying.
Yeah. That's kind of why I brought it up. But, yeah. Also in this, what we will know to be a suicide note, Charles requested an autopsy of him be done after his death, and that his remaining estate be donated to a mental health research facility.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So later that day, he stops writing this note on the typewriter. He goes and picks up his wife from her part-time summer job and took her to lunch at the cafeteria where his mom worked. And afterwards, he dropped Kathy off for her evening shift as a switchboard operator. He then headed to the Academy Outdoor Plus, which I didn't even know Academy was around
Academy
back then.
Sports and Outdoors, the right stuff, the right price.
I don't know if that's the same shop, but that's what I'm guessing.
Weird.
Yeah. So there he bought a hunting knife and a pair of binoculars. He goes to pay for his purchases with a check. And the lady receiving the check is supposed to check the ID. And he even offers, like, "Oh, do you want to see my ID?" And she says later to investigators, "No, he seemed like such a nice boy that I told him I didn't need to see his ID. He was so nice." So after Academy, he buys some Spam at a local 7-Eleven.
What?
I only brought that up because Spam is weird.
Is that his last meal?
I don't, you know what? I looked to see if the Spam was eaten, and I looked through crime scene photos, And part of me was just looking for
an empty can of spam,
and I didn't see one. So I don't know. He brings a lot of crap to this event that we're about to talk about, and you'll see. I don't know if half this stuff gets used.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I hope his last meal was a can of spam. Piece of garbage.
It's such weird meat. It makes its own gelatin.
Oh.
Any meat.
Ew, that like... Yeah, that jelly, that yellow jelly it gets.
Did you ever do that experiment in high school chemistry where you dissolve the spam and you actually get to see little bits of bone and stuff that's in there? Like, no. What's left in the spam?
Bone?
Yeah, there's like bits of cartilage and bone and stuff.
Oh my God,
there.
I'm going to throw up. Ugh.
Not a fan of spam. But hey, spam, if you're out there, I don't want a sponsorship.
Yeah, we have not been sponsored by Academy or Spam or 7-Eleven.
I'll take two of the three out of that one.
What if Spam offered to sponsor us just with like a pallet of Spam?
Ugh, nope. I'd turn it away.
Okay, good.
No Spam. Thank you, ma'am. Okay. After he goes to 7-Eleven, he then goes to a couple of other stores. Couldn't find the names of those, but he also acquires ammunition. He buys an M1 carbine, which is another rifle, and he basically tells the cashier there that he has a hog problem and needs a rifle. And she goes, okay, sure, and gives him the rifle. He buys a bunch of cans of other food and some bottles of water and some gasoline. So then he returns home. He continues working on his suicide note. Outlining what he planned to do, and you know that he was gonna have to kill his mom and his wife, and that he felt really bad about it, but he wanted to spare them from the events that were about to transpire. So around 9:30 p.m. Charles, he heads up and picks up Kathy from her job and returns home. Kathy's tired, it's late. She decides she's gonna go ahead and get ready for bed. While she's doing that, Charles calls his mother. He asks, hey, can I come over and study in the air conditioning? Because it's really hot and the air's out at their house. Of course, his mom's like, yeah, sure, come over. You need to study. Well, Kathy goes ahead and heads off to bed. And as soon as she does, Charles is out the door headed to his mom's house. As soon as he gets there to his mom's apartment, his mom answers the door in a nightgown and is like, okay, come on in, get cooled off. As soon as she turns around, he attacks her. Charles strikes her in the back of the head several times with what we think is the butt of the knife that he brought with him.
God.
He then continues to stab her with the knife.
Jeez.
Yeah. After she's dead, he picks up her body and he places it under the covers in her bed. And he closes her eyes to make it appear as though she was asleep. Now, again, remember that she tragically had recently moved to Austin to escape her brutal husband, Charles Sr.
And then gets murdered by her son.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Then he handpens a letter that he puts by her body. It says, quote, to whom it may concern, I have just taken my mother's life. I am very upset over having done it. However, I feel that if there is a heaven, she is definitely there now. And if there is no life after, I have relieved her suffering here on Earth. The intense hatred I feel for my father is beyond description. My mother gave that man the best 25 years of her life. So, some experts point to this as a way to leave Charles's father as the only one to answer for what he's about to do. And, like, he's calling him out in this note, and we're going to see by some of his other actions that there might be something to this theory.
Uh-huh. I just love that when you hear of somebody committing familicide, but it's for their benefit. It's like John Locke, if you've ever heard the story about John Locke, yeah, who kills his entire family because they were basically running out of money and were going to have to move out of their big fancy mansion and all that. So we decided to kill all of his family to relieve them of the trouble of living that way.
Oh, yeah.
But then just goes and moves to Europe and just continues his life for the next, like, 30, 40 years until he's finally caught. And it's like, what kind of eye-rolling narcissist do you have to be? I know we keep using that term, and I'm sorry, but
narcissism.
I don't know what else to say besides a narcissist or a psychopath or an egomaniac, somebody who who can use that as a, to them, a completely viable excuse to murder somebody. I'm doing it for their benefit.
Well, it's like Jim Jones and David Koresh were able to spin these outside forces and spin it in such a way where, like, these deaths are a benefit and a positive. And I'm not going to let these people be ruined by what is about to happen. I'm giving them some kind of gracious relief.
Yeah.
Which is BS. So after Charles leaves his mother's apartment, he leaves a little note of "do not disturb" on the door. And then he returns home. He creeps into the bedroom where Kathy is sleeping. He pulls out his military bayonet. You know what a bayonet is?
Yeah.
And he stabs her 5 times in the chest.
Oh my God.
I guess the only saving grace for Kathy is that she was most likely dead instantaneously because he stabbed her right in the heart.
Jeez. So I have a question. He, you know, he's amassed all these guns already. I'm assuming that he did not choose to shoot these two women because he didn't want to risk him getting caught, because he still had his big momentous plan to fall through on. So he couldn't risk getting caught. So instead he wanted to stab them to death. Is there any truth to that? Or...
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right, because we're going to see the next morning, he calls both of their work and tells both of their employers that they're sick.
Oh, yeah, because he doesn't want anybody sniffing around to, mm-hmm. and coming around to and figure out what he's done to them.
Exactly. And now he has carte blanche. He has all night to sit on this, what he's done, that now he's a multiple murderer, and he can plot and figure out what the next stage is.
Yeah. And so, not only that he's killed two people, but he's killed the two people who have loved him and supported him the most in his entire life.
Oh, yeah. Arguably the most important, awesome people that he had.
Wow.
You know, his wife was trying to get him help. His mother loved him. She tried to help him when he was younger to protect him from his father. Why them first?
Yeah.
And don't give me this crap that you're saving them for what's coming next. It's something psychological, very poignant, that he picked them specifically as the first two.
Yeah, because what would make sense if he was really doing this to take out the people who hurt him or to make a stand against something, why didn't he drive down to Florida, kill his dad, and then make his last stand there?
Yeah,
You know, or anything else to pick these two women to be the one that he killed, I think says something. I don't know what it is because I'm not a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
But it says something.
And that's what loses me on the theory of people saying, well, they left his father so that he had to be the one in the spotlight to explain all this as the last.
He's 26 years old. Who's going to blame his dad for something that he's doing now?
Yeah, and that's what I don't get. I don't get that theory of, like, leaving his dad in the limelight is some kind of punishment to him and all this. That, oh, obviously it's all your fault because everyone who's good is gone.
I wonder, because he mentioned heaven. I wonder, does he want to take them with him? Because he knows he's going to die. I mean, he's writing a suicide letter, as you've already written. So he has plans that he's going to be dying, too.
Why would he think he's going to go to heaven, though?
Does he want to... Well, in any kind of afterlife, I mean, who knows what's going on in this crazy person's head? Is it that thing where he has to have them with him? Like, it's this greediness?
Oh, I think it's a narcissistic thing, yes.
I'm taking them with me?
Yeah, they're mine, and they love me, and I'm going to see them out of this world.
Yeah.
And they're part of what I've built in this whole scenario.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very selfish, for sure. I think it's all about him.
Ugh, well, gross monster.
Oh, yeah. Well, it gets worse. So just like with his mother, he cleaned up a little bit. He pulled up the covers and closed Kathy's eyes to make it appear as though she had been sleeping. He then returned to the typewriter where his letter remained, and he wrote in blue ink, quote, "Monday, 3 a.m., both dead," underline.
This is in his suicide note, or is this like
right on his suicide note that's sitting in the typewriter there, and then finishing the letter, which the letter itself we'll link to. I'm not going to read the whole thing because it's 2 pages. It's typewriter, and half of it is handwritten and barely legible. But if you want to look at it and check it out, there's transcriptions and stuff. We'll link to it.
It's probably just a bunch of garbage It's a garbage manifesto.
Yeah, I mean, I would be fine with it.
I'm assuming it's of no value to anybody but a psychiatrist trying to learn more about a mad person.
Well, I mean, we might have fans that are interested in that kind of stuff.
Well, that's fine. I'm just saying, I don't think we really need to give him a voice on this.
Yeah, I'm not going to read it. But then he presumably goes to bed and wakes up very early the next morning and begins packing and planning. So this is August 1st, 1966. Charles pulls out an old military footlocker. He begins packing food for 2 weeks. He puts earplugs, matches, rope, a transistor radio, binoculars that he bought previously that we talked about, a machete, a can of charcoal starter, gasoline, a compass, flashlights, deodorant, toilet paper, batteries, and 3 hunting knives.
Deodorant?
Yeah.
Sorry, that's the one thing that, like, are you really worried about your fucking stench?
Well, and I think this, again, points to the fact that what he was saying earlier is you could defend against an army from up there for weeks. So in his mind, this is something that's going to go on as long as he can.
Days, weeks,
however long. He's putting in for the long haul.
Yeah. I'm just surprised that deodorant was on the list there.
Yeah, I thought that was a funny addition to the list. Toilet paper, too. So is he actually going to try and take a poop while holding off this tower?
Well, like you said, if he's expecting this to last days, I mean, you got to go.
I guess. Oh. Well, he also modified a brand new 12-gauge shotgun by sawing off the stock and barrel. So have you heard the term sawed-off shotgun? Yeah. Do you know what that is?
Okay, the stock is the thing that goes, like, against your chest, right?
Your shoulder, yeah.
Your shoulder, and then the barrel is the shooty thing.
The shooty thing is the technical term, yes.
I think when you cut off the barrel, it makes the spread even more.
Yes. It makes it potentially
more lethal in like a larger area at close range. Yeah.
But it's non-lethal at long range.
Yeah. Yeah.
So keep that in mind for later on, because this is actually going to turn against Charles.
Oh, what's the purpose of cutting off the stock?
I don't know. I'm not really sure. I guess because you can shoot it one handed. Because, you know, you don't have to put it against your shoulder. It's just kind of a handle at that point.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I think that's the correct answer. But, you know, put it in the comments, gun people. So, yeah, he packs the shotgun with the rest of his gear. And along with that, he includes 3 long rifles, 3 pistols, and 700 rounds of ammunition. But the prized possession that he's going to add to the trunk is his most precious rifle, the one that will actually do the most damage that we're going to see here in a minute, his 6mm Remington. So the 6mm Remington is what, as a Marine, he would do most of his target shooting with.
Wait, that's not a scoped, isn't that just like a pistol?
No, it's a rifle.
Oh, it's a rifle?
This is a rifle that is scoped that he does most of his long target shooting with.
Oh, okay. A 6mm sounds so like such a small caliber, I would think it would be like a little handgun or something.
No, it's a very fast military-grade rifle that he's using that's of the time period.
Oh, okay.
And he was very accurate at long distances with this rifle. So along with the 6mm Remington and the rest of his gear, he throws it in this military footlocker. He puts it on a 2-wheel dolly and rolls it into his car and packs it all up. And after that, he puts on some repairman's overalls. The repairman's overalls is kind of his disguise to get up into the tower.
Uh-huh.
And on your picture... Sorry,
I have one more question about the things that he packed. He only packed 700 rounds?
Yeah.
Well, I guess he is sniping as opposed to just shooter, like... Yeah. You know, fully automatic. Because I was going to say 700 rounds in like a semi-automatic or a full automatic is going to go by really fast. But if he's just sniping, I guess that makes more sense.
Like, let's say he hits 50% of the time, which is not good for a marksman. That's 350 people.
Yeah.
You know, that's a lot.
Yeah, that makes more sense. Okay, we can cut that. I just was like...
No, I think it's interesting.
Yeah. A lot of people, like, you know, the Vegas guy, he wasn't sniping, he was just
into the spraying, crowd.
700 rounds doesn't sound that much.
Well, that's what really, you know, keep that in mind for our discussion, because that's what really puts this guy in a different category from the Vegas shooter, is he's a marksman.
Yeah.
You know,
he's a military trained marksman.
Exactly. We've basically gotten to the point where Charles Whitman is all packed up, ready to go. He's about to head to his fantasy location at the University of Texas Clock Tower. And at this point, we're going to call it a little stop, a little time stop here. We're going to make this into a two-parter. And fear not, listeners, because we've got another episode dropping in just a couple of days, maybe 2 days, right?
Yeah, I'm thinking like 2 days.
Okay.
So you won't have to wait another week. We'll have the part two out in a couple of days, and then you'll get the next episode the following week, like usual.
Yeah.
And we are so nice to you guys.
And it's going to be hard to get through and brutal.
It is. It definitely is.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a brief respite before we get, even though there have already been deaths, there's going to be a lot more coming. As you know, I'm sure you've heard the story. So, you know, kind of prepare yourself for the horribleness that is the rest of this story.
You already got a little bit of his background, and you know the two murders that have already been committed and kind of the preparations, and you can kind of see some foreshadowing. Push us over onto something decent to talk about, Aaron, to wrap this part one up.
Oh, are you talking about some good news?
Yeah, good news.
We really need to get some good news music going just to close out the episode, make you start feeling good again all of the horrible things that we're talking about.
Though that might be coming pretty soon, because I found some.
Oh, good. Well, I guess I'll wait for that, just like the audience will. I have a little bit of good news, and like a lot of the good news that we've seen, it's a little sad at first, but it's also really good, and I think will make you feel a little bit warm in the heart. This news comes from Tomball, Texas, T-O-M-B-A-L-L. I had to look up where that is. That is a little city outside Houston. And
again with the Houston.
Well, I'm sorry. Houston either has really terrible things happening or really good things happening.
Step up your game, rest of Texas.
One or the other.
We need good stories from other parts of the Texas. And hey, listeners, if you have a good news story, send it to us.
No, seriously, because they are hard to find.
Yeah.
They genuinely are.
It's personally why I don't watch the news, is because of all the bad news.
Yeah, they just don't like good news.
They don't like human interest stories.
But we do here at ACNC.
Yes.
This is good news about a teacher. Her name is Michelle Wistrand, and she is a very excellent teacher, and I think you're going to figure out how well-loved she is by her students. But unfortunately, last February, as she was nearing her retirement, her last year of teaching at Tomball Junior High School, she was diagnosed with leiomyosarcoma, which is a cancer of the soft tissue. And her doctors gave her about 2 to 5 years to live.
Oh, no.
Yeah, really, really terrible. But she was trying to be as positive about this as possible. And she developed a little bit of a bucket list. And this bucket list she shared with her eighth grade students there at the junior high school. And in order for her to complete the things on her bucket list, her students got together and they developed all of these fundraisers and a GoFundMe account. They were able to raise $11,500 for Miss Wistrand to go on this epic tour of the United States to basically be able to check off these things from her bucket list. And so what she was able to do was she went to the Redwood Forest. She went and put her feet in the Pacific Ocean. She went to see sea turtles in Florida. She visited her son who was doing some kind of stage performance in Iowa. She went to the Grand Hotel in Mackinac Island in Michigan, which is where one of her favorite films was filmed. So basically this huge tour of the United States, and it was all funded by the help of her students, which I think is saying a lot because eighth grade students are like the worst, meanest beings on the planet.
Yeah, and half the time they're so airbrained they don't bring pencil and paper or take the time to turn in their homework, even though they've already done it.
Oh, that was me. But yeah, exactly. Eighth graders are the worst. So, I mean, I think it's saying a lot that they went through all of this trouble to try to get this this wonderful trip for their, you know, their favorite teacher. And she was able to do all of these things that were on her bucket list, all of these things that she really, really wanted to do.
That's amazing.
And She documented her travels on this trip on her Instagram account. So you can actually check out some of her photos on @WistrandBucketList. So go ahead and check that out. You can see some of her photos. Obviously, you know, it is sad. It is a woman who is going to die. You know, she has been given this diagnosis, but she's making the best of it. And she's going through hospice care right now. And she's done so many things in her life to be proud of. And she says that she's not afraid of death. You know, we deal a lot with death in the true crime community, and we always see it as this horrible negative thing, which it often is. But I think this story is actually really nice because it's somebody who has accepted that there is an end to their life that's coming up, you know, sooner rather than later. And she's able to, you know, do the things that she wants to do, have so many people in her life that love her and are willing to take care of her and just be happy and live in the moment. And she says that she doesn't fear death. And I think that's a really great place to be for somebody who is in this position of having this illness, which has shortened their life greatly. So yeah. I think it's a nice story. Obviously, like I said, it's sad, but I think it's also a really good thing that these students came together and like did this fundraising, and this woman was able to go on this really fantastic trip.
Yeah, it's very cool. It's awesome. And good for the students.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tomball Junior High School. Good for you.
Good job. All right. So that's about it. A wrap for us. We're going to wait till part two of this episode to throw out some shout outs and reviews. So stay tuned for that at the end of part two.
Be sure to follow us on our social media accounts. We're on Instagram @AllCrimeNoCattle and on Twitter @ACNCPodcast. And we're also on Facebook. So go ahead and give our Facebook page a like. And as we've been doing the last few weeks, if you give us a 5-star review either on iTunes or on Facebook, we will read your iTunes review. And, you know, it can be whatever you want.
Yeah. Funny jokes. Stories about cows, whatever you like.
Why cows?
Because we're all crime, no cattle. It's,
oh, yeah. Who has a story about a cow? If you have one, let us know.
Yep. Do you have anything else, Aaron?
Happy Valentine's Day.
Yeah, happy Valentine's.
To those of you who celebrate it. What are we going to be doing on Valentine's Day, Shay? Probably recording and editing?
Probably.
Oh, what fun.
Yeah. Yep.
All right, well, bye.
Always remember, guys, crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.